Welcome to the Leadership Journey Podcast. My name is Alan Wilson, and I'm the host of the podcast. Each week, I will be talking to various Christian leaders, discussing some of the things that have contributed to the story of their leadership, and at the same time, encouraging you to reflect on your own leadership journey. You can subscribe to the podcast via iTunes. Just look for the Leadership Journey Podcast, and while you're there, you can leave us a review. Meantime, enjoy the podcast. This week, my guest on the podcast is Sir Nigel Hamilton. Up until now, my guests have tended to be leaders whose careers have been set in the context of the church or some specifically Christian organisation. Sir Nigel's story is different in that his professional career was worked out over more than 30 years in the civil service, including eventually serving as head of that organisation. So instead of needing to work out how to relate to elders and deacons, he was working out how to relate to more than 30 various government ministers. Much of that career spanned what's become known in Northern Ireland as the Troubles, and in the interview he reflects on some of what happened during the time. He also discusses some of the ways he found support as a Christian during his career, including his involvement in the Methodist Church, in which he'd become a lay preacher. And in this context, we discuss the importance of church leaders supporting members of their congregation who are involved in senior roles outside of the walls of the church. He also talks about what it means to exercise faith, Christian faith, in senior leadership situations. And I should also say, for any fans of Yes Minister and Yes Prime Minister, that programme does get a mention. Nigel, you're very welcome to the Leadership Journey podcast. Thank you for taking the time to be with us. I should say, just by the way, you're different from others who've already been on the podcast, because generally speaking, we've had people who are ministers or pastors or Bible college principals or retired Bible college principals. And as we're here on this chat that we have, your track has been somewhat different, but just a little word or two just about who is Nigel Hamilton.
Nigel Hamilton is a boy who originally came from North Belfast, and through the school system and then through Queen's, I ended up working in the Northern Ireland Civil Service, and it was a privilege to work there. Working my way through the civil service, through some of the interesting times in life, my career tended to be interspersed with the political developments.
Okay, well, we'll visit some of that there. Yeah. But I mean, who are you today?
I am Nigel Hamilton, father, two sons, husband of a terrific wife who supported me throughout all my life. Doting grandparent of
doting
three grandchildren.
Grandparent. Okay. Yes. Yeah, I've never heard of one of those before.
of course, you've joined.
Yes, I know. Joined the club, yeah.
Two boys and a girl, and another on the way, which is terrific. And also someone who, at my stage in life, is also... I am still involved in a number of activities that I thoroughly enjoy and that I like to think, in some sense, I'm giving back to some of the things that life has given me.
Yeah, well, I know the last time I saw you just a few days ago at an event of that was put on by the New Irish Arts, and that's an involvement that you have at the moment.
Yes.
We can talk, we can talk a little bit about that. Right. I need to say something about the civil service, though. It's an admission, and I don't think you'll mind this, but when Pauline and I are on a long car journey, as we were recently, we were down in County Galway, one of the things that we do on these road trips is that we have an audiobook of Yes Minister and Yes Prime Minister. And of course, that whole thing of the civil service and Sir Humphrey Appleby and so on. Are you a fan?
Oh, very much so. I have the whole box set, and I've watched them over the years.
Yeah. How realistic is it?
Like anything in life of that nature, Alan, it's a bit of an exaggerated caricature, but some of the chemistry and some of the interrelationships in it are true. And indeed, it's not the first time in my life that I've said to a minister, "That's interesting, Minister. That would be very courageous if you want to do that."
Anybody who's listening who hasn't familiarised themselves with some of the terminology that Humphrey uses, you need to dig in. But courageous, of course, is code word for, you know, it's on your head.
Absolutely.
Good. Well, we'll get to talk about the civil service in due course, but let's go back to growing up in Belfast, North Belfast. And schooling and so on there. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I come from a family, a mum and dad and one sister, and we grew up in the Old Park area of Belfast. I went to Finiston School, which a few years after I left, interestingly, became an army barracks. So that was the area in which we lived. Then in 1959, I actually passed the 11 plus. But the grammar schools in Belfast decided not to have me as a student. And I ended up postcode. Where we lived subsequently. But
was that purely geographical, or was there anything else going on?
It's difficult to know. It's difficult to know. But you know, looking back, you know, and we, I know we'll come to this, but you know, I very much believe in guidance at the time, and I went to the Belfast Boys Model, which was my launching pad for life. I had a great time there. I ended up actually as the head boy there, and it gave me a love for for example for rugby, but it, I also left in 1966 to go to Queen's with 42 other boys, which was amazing that time.
Can I ask you a question about the boys' model? Yeah. There's a story that I heard some time ago about a teacher who ruled with a rod of iron. There may be than one who ruled with a rod of iron. And the story was of a boy who'd left, who'd finished school on Friday, got a job. You know, he was he'd become a window cleaner. And had come in the next, his first assignment was to work in his old school, had arrived in the school playground without his school uniform on, obviously, and was commanded by one of these teachers to go and wait for him, you know, to be interviewed for this breach of discipline. Do you know this story?
I know the story, but I also know the individual.
Okay.
Because there was an individual, the teacher.
Yeah.
Yes, there was a very strong directive approach to education. And corporal punishment was the order of the day. Having said that, you know, we were forced to work. You know, so that when I was doing junior certificate and GCSE, there were Friday afternoon and Saturday morning classes. With the result that everyone in the class got distinctions in junior certificate, and that was just the nature of the working environment. But the same individual also coached the first 15 in 1971 to win the school's cup, and the boys' model is the only ever non-grammar school to have won the school's cup.
Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah.
And we may come to this later on, but some of us a few years ago decided we want to do something in his memory. So we have set up a bursary fund, and in fact, at senior prize giving 3 weeks ago, I gave 9 boys from the school checks for £1,000 each to go to university.
Wow, that's fantastic. That's fantastic. That's great. Now, I know that during your time there, there was a personal loss.
Yes.
Do you want to talk about that?
Yes. In 1965, my dad, who was 41...
So at this stage, you're... Lower sixth.
Yeah. My dad died at 41, and that was obviously a big sort of trauma in my life. And looking back, actually, you know, up until that point, I was sort of quite a shy young boy. But it made a huge difference. I also, too, and at very early in our conversation, I want to pay tremendous tribute to my mother, because after my father died, my mother went out and had several jobs, some of which were menial, because she was absolutely determined that my sister and I would have the best education that we possibly could. So I went to Queen's and my sister went to University of Ulster in Coleraine at the time, funded by my mother, who's still living, to whom I owe so much.
That's lovely. That's really great. But how did it affect you when you lost your dad?
It was a shock. I mean, I knew. So he'd had cancer, and he'd been in a lot of pain. But you know, just at that point of loss, was quite traumatic. I then was sort of thrust into becoming the only man in the family at that stage. But looking back, You know, one of my great regrets is that my dad, who was a very practical man, he was heavily involved in Crumlin Road Methodist Church as the property steward. Mm-hmm. He used to go there three or four nights a week, etc. One of my great regrets is that he never met my sons or my grandsons, because they would have loved his company and he theirs.
Yeah, absolutely. What you mentioned church there and the involvement in the Methodist Church. What about faith and influences and, you know, coming to faith yourself?
Well, my parents were heavily involved in Crumlin Road Methodist, as indeed was the whole family at that time. And obviously, I was a regular attender at Sunday school. I think looking back, church going and the Christian faith was an endemic part of everything that I did, and it really certainly wasn't until at school when I was 15 someone invited me to the Scripture Union. From then on, I really developed a much deeper faith at that point, because then you're forced to think.
Yeah.
And I had great love and respect for Scripture Union. As a man of 70 now, for a long time, we've been supporters of CSSM over the summer and the great work that Scripture Union do in schools and still do.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a very major influence in my life at that point.
And would you say that influence was largely in helping you to personalize a faith that it had been part of your surroundings?
Very personal and challenging, but also requiring you to think through your faith and what it meant.
So after school, then it's off to Queen's to study.
Well, I originally went to Queen's to study geography.
Right.
I did it as a BSc. I had to pick a fourth subject, and like 300 or 400 other people at that time, I picked psychology as my fourth subject
because it had an ology in the end of it.
Yeah, because it sounded interesting. And at the end of first year, the professor sent for me and said, "Look, you've done well. We'd like to offer you a place in the honour school."
To study honours psychology. Yeah.
And had I still been doing geography, I would have had to wait until the end of third year to know whether I was going to go back for the fourth year honours course.
Yeah.
So I decided, yes, I would do that. The problem was that to do honours psychology, I needed to do second year zoology or physiology.
Oh my goodness.
Neither of which I'd studied.
Yeah.
So I worked really hard.
Yeah.
I got 41% in the physiology exam.
Yeah.
I was with the medics and didn't understand the terminology, etc. But I really enjoyed psychology. But I think the other big influence, if I may say, my time at Queen's, the biggest thing that has helped to drive me was my involvement in the Christian Union at that time.
What did that look like?
Oh, it was terrific. There was a weekly meeting with, you know, at that time maybe 400 or 500 people.
Mm-hmm.
We had all the great preachers from Northern Ireland and beyond.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the great influence in all our lives at that time, I was there from 66 to 70, was John Stott.
Yes.
John Stott's writings. I even, to this day, Alan, remember him coming to speak on balanced Christianity, the need to be, you know, conservative and evangelical, sorry, social and evangelical, conservative and radical. I still remember all of that.
So you heard him speak?
I heard him speak several times.
Yes. Okay, yeah. Now, in all of that, was there an emerging sort of potential for leadership that people saw? Were people inviting you into leadership positions at that time?
Well, I was... I was astonished to be appointed head boy.
Yeah.
It was because I had gone back for a third, because my father had died, I'd gone back for a third year sixth, and was made head boy. I never saw this coming.
Mm-hmm.
Never saw this coming. And yet, you know, it was a tremendous honour. I will also tell you that at that time, the prefects and the head boys and the boys model were entitled to purchase a crimson honours blazer. which I still have.
Because the rest of the blazers were, what, navy?
Navy, right, yes. Okay, yeah. So I still have my Crimson Honours blazer.
Uh-huh, yeah. I'm not going to ask you whether you can still fit into it. I dare say you could, actually.
I can fit into it, but it may not button.
But I think for people who don't actually know you to see, and people are listening here, it's audio, I do need to say you're very trim. Yeah.
Well,
don't want to give the wrong impression that you've sort of massively outgrown your 18-year-old blazer or anything like that. So what do you think they saw in you then that they appointed you as head boy?
That's an interesting question. You know, perhaps they saw some leadership. Maybe they saw it as a reward at that time for the work, you know, that I was doing in the school, or my application rather in school. And that was probably the first stage of my leadership. Then when I went to Queen's, some folk actually, interestingly, challenged the Christian Union to say, look, you're a holy huddle. It's about time some of you got really involved in student politics. So a number of us stood for the Students' Representative Council at the time, and we served on that for 2 years.
You were elected on that then?
I was elected by my faculty year to do that.
Yeah.
And I did some work on the Committee of Christian Union as well. So that began...
Were you president?
No.
Right,
no.
Okay.
And I wasn't president, because, first of all, I was never asked, and secondly, I would never have accepted it. Mm. I didn't have the confidence in terms of public speaking in those days, or praying in public, you know. And there were some very gifted folk with whom I'm still friendly, whose company I cherished at that time.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the role of Scripture Union. You mentioned the university environment. Listening to someone like John Stott, were there particular individuals who had an influence on you, either just by the people that they were, or because they took an interest in you, or they taught you, or?
I was very fortunate that I had a group of friends in Queens. Mm-hmm. You know, one chap who's gone off to the States. So both, two of whom, one of whom, a chap, Billy Abraham, who's a professor of systematic theology, and a very, very intelligent guy. And we were friends together. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't say that I had sort of elderly mentors at that time.
Sure.
But I had a group. A peer group who were very, very important.
Yeah. Interestingly, in one of the previous podcasts was with Helen Warnock. You'll know Helen,
yes,
Scripture Union and so on, before she went to BBC. But she talked about the value of a group of peers and friends, and the way that they challenge one another, and, you know, very, very important. So you had a similar thing.
I had the similar thing.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm also very supportive of Christian Union in Ireland, mm-hmm, and also very encouraging to folk I know, you know, in their university days, to both enjoy university life, mm-hmm, but have some sort of peer group to whom you can relate, who could support you, and with whom you can chat, you know, in a very relaxed way.
Yeah. Okay. That's great. So what happened then after university? Was it straight into the civil service at that point?
In August 1970, I had two letters in the same week. One was from Queen's, offering me a grant of £97 a term to do a PhD in educational psychology.
Ooh.
And the other was a letter from the civil service offering me a job as a graduate entrant to the civil service.
Uh-huh. How long did it take you to decide?
Well, I took a week or two to decide. Yeah. And I went to speak to a Christian chap I knew who worked in the civil service, who said to me, only join the civil service if they're going to offer you a job as a graduate entrant, and if you're going to DOE, because that was the Ministry of Development, as it then was.
Right.
It's a brand new department with lots of opportunities.
Yeah.
And that's exactly the offer that was given to me.
Right.
I also thought at the time, Alan, you know, having done psychology as a major, and having done a dissertation in an educational psychology area, Piaget, you may remember, I thought, am I going to want to spend the rest of my life, you know, doing this? Mm-hmm. So I chose to go to the civil service, mm-hmm, and never, ever regretted it.
Okay, right. And so much for the PhD then, and so much...
Well, The irony is that, in a wonderful way, in 2008, the University of Ulster gave me one. They gave me a doctorate.
Right. Excellent.
Although I still sometimes hanker after, you know, studying for a doctorate.
Right. What school in the university gave you the doctorate?
They gave me a
education.
No. They gave me a doctor of administration public administration.
Okay. So, right. Excellent. That's great. Now, I think it's helpful helpful as we're talking about this. You mentioned 1970, mm-hmm. and people who have lived for a while here in Northern Ireland are well aware of the events that were starting to unfold in around that time. So much of your career then was around the time of what we've come to know as the Troubles.
Yes, maybe two comments. Just one, during my time, the latter 2 years in Queens, that was the time of the rise of civil rights movement and what was called the people's democracy. Mm-hmm. And that was a challenge for those of us who were Christians. Did we want to participate in this, you know? And I remember actually being involved with a number of the university chaplains in those days, where we thought we wouldn't go on the civil rights marches, mm-hmm. but we actually walked alongside to prevent, any aggro or
against the marchers.
Yeah. Uh-huh. It was the right thing to do. Then I joined the civil service in 1970 and worked there until 2008. So
just remind us politically, there was. Stormont Mark 1 or
Stormont,
whatever at that
Stormont point. Was yeah. still there mm-hmm. until mm-hmm. it collapsed in roughly 1971.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. For the next of my 38 years in the civil service, for the period up until 1996, till the ceasefires, we were effectively at war. Mm-hmm. And so that very much drove our approach to things, mm-hmm. particularly as I moved my way up through the civil service. It was much about continuing the delivery of public services, mm-hmm. rather than new innovative things that could be done, because that was the prevailing culture at the time. Mm-hmm. In those 38 years, I worked out that I worked recently that I reported directly to 39 separate ministers.
Oof.
between direct rule and devolution.
Yeah. Goodness me! Have you written a book?
No.
All right, so it's not the memoirs then. No.
No, and you know, I know you asked that in slight jest, but I always said to all the ministers to whom I worked, I was particularly at very senior level, I always said two things. Firstly, I'm not keeping a diary.
Yeah.
And secondly, I'm never writing a book.
Yeah.
Because it seemed to me that I had to have their trust and their confidence. Yes. Uh-huh. And if they thought that I was going to do that subsequently, mm-hmm. I think it would have undermined that relationship.
Which is very honourable. There's a lot of integrity in that. Yeah. You could easily see that someone else would not have made that promise. Yes. And for whom the fact they'd worked with 39 ministers would be a remarkable opportunity to sell a big book.
Well, no, I don't think I would have the discipline actually to sit down and write it. But I think much more importantly is that, you know, I was keeping a promise. And I've tried to keep that promise. You know, for example, I never, ever talked about my relationship with Ian Paisley and Martin McGuinness, mm-hmm. because when I was head of the civil service, mm-hmm. they were there until both of them had passed away. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because it seemed to me that that was, the right thing to do.
You were in a privileged position and that had to stay.
That's right.
I had to stay like that. What were some of the big things that happened during those years then? You know, I'm thinking we'll maybe talk about your career and some of the key moments in your career, but some of the things that were affecting Northern Ireland that therefore impacted what you were doing.
Well, just to go back to something I sort of alluded to earlier, my career was basically around two or three big themes. Mm-hmm. The first you'd probably call physical infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So I worked in the old Ministry of Development and then DOE on roads and water and housing and inner city regeneration. Mm-hmm. But from the early 70s, I was also involved directly in some of the big political controversies of the time. So that, for example, in 1971, after internment, a number of nationalist councillors withdrew in places like Newry and Strabane and Cady, and the department had to appoint commissioners to effectively replace the councils. So I was one of six commissioners on the commission to look after Cady. Which was an interesting experience.
There's probably very few people listening to this have any clue where it is.
Well, it's on the border. It's in South Armagh on the border. Yeah. And, you know, for example, just to, for those who may not know, you know, it was a very small council. The refuse collection was a man on a tractor on a Wednesday afternoon. then coming into the 80s, I had responsibility for local government. And that was at the time of the signing of the Anglo-Irish Agreement. And a number of unionist-controlled councils decided that in opposition to the agreement, they wouldn't meet. So I then, at that point, had to... Well, I did two separate things I had to do. First of all, personally, I had to strike the rates for 16 of the 26 councils. Now, that meant taking advice from the chief executives. But also, on three or four occasions, we had to appoint commissioners to take decisions in Belfast, Castlereagh and Newton Abbey. Because not to do that would have meant that the staff wouldn't have been paid and the services wouldn't have continued. So that was an interesting experience in the 80s. And then, and at the time, there were also, for example, there was also a proposal to change the name of the then Londonderry City Council. So I actually had to sign the order that changed the name.
To Derry City Council. Yes. Yeah, which of course, again, anybody listening outside of Northern Ireland is going to think, well, what's all that about? Yeah. But it's very political.
It was very political.
But can I ask you a question? I'm not sure this is necessarily an easy question to answer, but how successful do you think the civil service was during those years, maybe particularly the 70s, at remaining politically neutral in all that was going on? Was that a very difficult path to walk?
It was probably less difficult in those days, to be honest, Alan, than it is in the most recent period of devolution. Because in those days, well, we had a storm in Parliament for a while, then it collapsed, then we had direct rule, and we had Conservative direct rule and Labour direct rule. So you weren't really being sucked into party political issues.
Right, the direct rule bit.
On the direct rule bit. Then, but I think the difficulty for civil servants, fast forwarding to 97, 98, 99, when we really had full-blown devolution restored, is that if you have ministers of a strong political identity locally, you know, particularly, for example, now DUP and Sinn Féin, civil servants have to be very careful that they have to be independent and not simply and only reflecting the party political views of that party.
And yet civil servants, being human, inevitably are going to have their own political leanings, isn't that right?
Yes, but you have to be independent. You know, you have your own views, but you know, the objective of the civil service is, on the one hand, to deliver public services, and on the other hand, at senior levels, to offer policy advice. And you do that in a very, you'd like to think, reasoned and balanced and non-party political way. At the end of the day, if a minister takes a policy decision, it's the role of the civil service to implement it, but it's the role of the minister to justify it publicly. And there's a clear differentiation there.
Well, Nigel, during those years, and there were a lot of dreadful things happening. Were there any particular events that stand out that had a particular impact on you or your work?
Yes. In 1987, I was working in Stormont Castle as a sort of Batman to Sir Kenneth Bloomfield when his house was blown up.
And Kenneth Bloomfield was
he was the then head of the civil service.
He was the then head of the civil service.
In Stormont Castle. And in fact, they had put four bombs, one at each corner of his house, and three of them had gone off. The fourth one didn't, and he and his wife and his daughter came out past it. Now, that was very significant because that was the first time, really, that senior civil servants had been attacked. Obviously, we'd had some horrendous experiences with police and prison officers and the army, etc., but not the civil service. I never forget, you know, that happened early morning. By lunchtime, Ken Bloomfield, as we knew him, was back in the office, just determined that that his work would continue. But the rest of us who were working with him then had to undergo, obviously, security checks around homes, etc., in terms of ensuring that our behaviour, our method of travel, the protection in our home was adequate. And that was quite a traumatic time.
Yeah, was that must have put tremendous stress then on your wife and family?
Yes, you try, Alan, not to bring that home. And yet, you know, at that time, and the civil service was no different from, as I said, some of the other folk other groups that I've mentioned. But you know, you have to check. We had to check our cars every morning. You'd change your route to the office, change your time. I never forget, we had just bought a new house. And we had a gravel driveway. And when the security guy came out just to check around, he said, don't ever have your driveway tarmacked, because people don't like walking on gravel because it makes a noise. Oh,
yes. My goodness. Yeah, I mean, you can say, you know, you don't bring that home, but yeah, it was home.
Oh, it was
you
home.
You had to make sure your
yes.
home
but
was
But you had
safe.
To try and, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
You had to try and protect your home from all of that.
Yeah. What about faith during that whole era of civil service time? Was there, you know, were you part of a Christian fellowship within the civil service? Or?
There was a Christian fellowship in the civil service, but it was quite small. I was very fortunate. Fortunate's not the right word to use, but I was blessed because I had a number of very close friends who were Christians outside. One in particular, with whom I could share. This particular individual was involved at a senior level in public service as well. So we were able to meet together. In fact, we were able to, for example, drive to Dublin to watch a rugby match, and we could chat to one another. That was very important. I was also involved at that time in the Methodist Church. With wonderful folk like Eric Gallagher, Harold Good, Sidney Callaghan, all of whom were tremendously tremendously insightful in what was happening. I learned so much from just watching them at the time, and they were sort of father figures to me at that time. The interesting thing, just going back to the security check in my house, was that the security guy said, at the end of it all, he said, look, you're wise in that you do X and Y and Z and move around. He said, you're most vulnerable because you go to church same time every Sunday morning and park your car in the church car park. To which my response was, well, look, I'm going to continue to do that because that's such an important part of my life.
Yeah. So that was a Methodist church at the time?
That was a Methodist church in 1987.
Did you have any roles in church life at that point? Were they asking you to take responsibilities?
Yeah, I had. Well, I was. The church centrally had a council which was responsible for social and policy issues, and I served on that council. I'd also, by then, I'd been a lay preacher. In fact, I qualified as a lay preacher in 1974, and then I had a role in my local church, all of which was very important, because I always tried, in all that I did, I tried very hard to make sure that nothing impinged on Sunday worship and my Sunday relationships with my family. We have a wife and two boys at the time, and I tried to protect that. You know, I also tried to make sure that on a Saturday afternoon I'd go off and play rugby. I was a referee, which was important, just to stay fit.
Yeah. Can I ask you a question about church in relation to your work? Through your career, well, from the perspective of the career that you've had and your involvement in church, what advice would you give, say, to church leaders? If there's someone who's a member of their congregation, there are loads of people who are members of their congregation, who's who've got massive responsibilities in quote unquote the secular world. How can those church leaders best support members of their church who are so active and have got fairly high profiles outside of the church?
I think it's very important that those folk are supported and encouraged, particularly in a pastoral sense. One of the things that I would say, you know, I was a permanent secretary for 4 years and head of the civil service for 6 years. Those are lonely places to be, as are jobs as chief executives or senior levels in the private sector or in the third sector, in the charitable sector. Those folk, I think, just need encouragement from folk outside those businesses in a non-threatening, supportive and encouraging way. You know, I love Barnabas in the New Testament, and I think it's interesting that the first time we read about Barnabas, he sold his field to give money to the disciples. And then in Acts 11:22, we read about Barnabas being sent to Antioch. And it said, you know, he was a he was there to encourage the believers. And I can just imagine him doing that in a collective way, but in an individual way. And I just think it's very important. I mean, folk in senior levels have lots of pressures. And they need to be able to unwind and talk to non-threatening folk of whom the pastor would be important.
Yeah, and for the pastor and others to do that in a way that it's not, you know, in some way exploiting. Well, I know somebody who's very senior and very responsible. Yeah, I think, you know, I think probably lots of people are aware of this, but in churches, very often we put on pedestals ministers, pastors, missionaries. You know, we have them up the front, we pray for them. I'm not suggesting that people bring everybody up to the front to pray for them, but I suspect that we neglect a little bit at times people who are involved in those other kind of roles because they don't fit what we commonly think of as Christian vocation.
Sometimes we use the term full-time minister, which excludes lay folk. You know, we're all in a full-time ministry, just in a different location.
That's right.
But I do think it's very important that those folk know that there is support, a supportive mechanism, and pastors and folk that you can talk to. You know, so that I mean, one of my dear friends towards the end of my career was Derek Bingham. And Derek and I used to meet regularly. When we chatted, you know, he wanted to talk politics and I wanted to talk theology. But we were non-threatening. And it was just a wonderful opportunity on a regular basis to chat around things. And I think that's very important too. Could I say something else just too about senior positions? The big challenge is in how we exercise our Christian faith in those situations. And I think it's extremely important, Alan, that folk know what our value base is. Let me give you an illustration. I mean, I was in the Department of Education and I was in DRD and the head of the civil service. I've made hundreds of speeches as a civil servant. I don't think I ever preached in those speeches. But I hope I never missed an opportunity to talk about the value base. Because it seems to me that, you know, those Christian values, you know, which we all love and which are part of our DNA of integrity, of truth, of honesty, of respect for the individual, those are very important. And, you know, we want to ensure that every Christian in a secular society, whether that's be at work or school, wherever it might be, or sport, shares and displays those values.
Great. Listen, we're going to leave it there. That's a good way to finish. Lots to think about in terms of that. The challenge, both for church leaders, how do you support folk in senior roles, and for Christians who are in senior roles, how do you go about owning those values as a witness? Nigel, thank you for your time on this broadcast. We will be back and we'll talk some more. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to Nigel for sharing with us, and thank you for listening. Nigel will be back on the podcast next week when, among other things, he'll be sharing some of his top leadership learnings. Meantime, have a good week, and God bless you in your own leadership journey.